We're going to ask two questions tonight. Number one, is it reasonable to believe in God? Number two, we're going to ask the question, what if there is no God? So what does that mean? I'm going to move relatively quick, but we are going to be wading through some sort of heavy cerebral stuff. So if there's a word you don't understand or a concept you don't understand or a group of sentences, if there's several minutes where I'm not making sense, please raise your hand. I love to interact. I am a preacher I preach more than I teach, right? So sometimes I'll just keep going, you know, because when you're preaching, you just keep on going. So I'll shift into preacher mode sometimes and forget to stop. So you can stop me. And if you are feeling timid, whisper your question to Pug. And she'll have no problem at all stopping me, right, Pug? And so, welcome back, Pug. We're so glad to have you here. I had to make one public Pug joke just so she felt welcome. And so, we'll see. Night's not over. There may be more, but for right now, we're sticking with that one. Is it reasonable to believe in God? Here's a quote. If there's no God, then what are all these churches doing here? And who is Jesus' dad? That's Michael Scott from The Office. The reality is, we're asking the question, is it reasonable to believe in God? I think we can come up with a better answer than Michael Scott did. Michael Gary Scott, brilliant guy, but maybe not the best logic for thinking about who God is. Let me restate the question. Is it more reasonable to believe that there's no God than it is to believe there is a God? Now, if you ask our culture, right, the answer to that question is a resounding yes. I mean, many people in our culture would say it is much more reasonable to believe that there's no God than it is to believe that there is a God. In fact, there might be some Christians who would say yes to that, right? Just because that's so in the water in the culture in which we live. Reason leads us to atheism and lack of reason or faith, which is not the opposite of reason, by the way. Lack of reason or faith leads us to believing in a fairy tale. In this, you know, this fairy tale man in the sky. And I still see people saying things like that. It's always so funny to me. The internet is a good place for simpletons to seem smart to themselves. And anyway, if you ever want to meet dullards, go to the internet, and specifically to the comment sections. But long story short, let me just say, let's go to Twitter if you want to encounter more dullards than you can shake a stick at, you know? All that being said, I still see people say, you know, like it's some devastating blow to a person of faith, like you believe in an imaginary old man in the sky to make yourself feel better about X, Y, or Z or whatever else. So there's still just kind of out there in the water this... Sometimes we play with a handicap that we don't even have to play with, as if we know it's not that reasonable to believe in God. But I would argue that it is not more reasonable to believe that there's no God than it is to believe that there is a God. I'm not one of these guys that's like, you just got to take it on faith, pure faith, unfounded faith. There's no such thing as unfounded faith. The Bible clearly says faith is based on evidence. It's evidence of things we can't see, but it's not unreasonable to believe in God. Let me start with this. You cannot prove that there's a God. Elijah did it. I get it. But you know what I mean. There's no way for me right now to just sit here and just have some slam dunk answer. In fact, if I could do that, right, we would just sort of, you know, call it a semester. He's like, here it is, and there it's done. There's no way to kind of give this slam dunk proof that a lot of people want. But the converse is also true. It's impossible to prove that there isn't a God. And I think that's something that's important for us to remember. In one book, Tim Keller says it like this. To state that there is no God or that there is a God then necessarily entails faith. And so the declaration that science is the only arbiter of truth is not itself a scientific finding. It is a belief. Okay? So in other words, what you'll have here, by the way, this is a book called Making Sense of God by Tim Keller. If you're interested, if you enjoy this book at all, I would strongly suggest picking this book up as well. This is one of my favorite books I've ever read, honestly. I think it's so good. It's a little older now. Let's see when this came out. I think pre-COVID, in fact. Um, 2016. Good night. I'm old. 10 years, a decade old now. Reason for God's even older than that. This is another Tim Keller book that I'm going to quote from a time or two tonight. But Making Sense of God, I think, is a really, really remarkably good book. And then I will say, though, that McLaughlin is sort of in Keller's vein in a lot of ways, but some of her arguments are a little updated. So all that to say, Keller's with the Lord now, but those are really helpful. And I feel like his quote there, in short, he says it like this on page 36, Making Sense of God. I know you don't have it, but I'm just going to make sure it's clear that I'm not saying this myself. In short, no one can purge him or herself of all faith assumptions and assume an objective, belief-free, pure openness to objective evidence. There is no view from nowhere. This was something that especially maybe when I was in college that felt like was kind of the idea du jour, was that we could be completely unbiased, that we could just approach anything truly objectively and use the scientific method or pure reason or mere reason and come to some semblance of the truth. But the reality is that you don't come to anything unbiased, do you? You just don't come to anything unbiased. If you go to Yellowstone on a day that's freezing cold and overcast and you can't see the views and, you know, Old Faithful sprung a leak and so you know that it's down for the day or whatever, you come out and you're like, man, Yellowstone's terrible. You know what I mean? I'd rather go to Gatlinburg or whatever. You go there on a pretty day, right, and you see Old Faithful and you see all the beautiful stuff and a wolf crosses the road and you get to see a tourist get too close to a buffalo and regret it. And you're like, man, it's the coolest place I've ever been in my life. You know, it's amazing. So even something as objective as like me going to Yellowstone and you going to Yellowstone can be very, very different experiences, right? Me going to Yellowstone on one day and me going to Yellowstone on another can be two very, very different experiences. Same with like a restaurant or something like that. We understand that there's biases, there. When I was in high school, we did a mock trial in your senior year, and even something as what time it is back in 2003 was something that people might struggle with. Now, today, it's easier to come by because we don't depend on watches the way we used to, right? We've now all got iPhone standard time getting piped in to our phones, and so it's a little bit easier, but I can remember there were some time discrepancies in the little trial that we'd been given. And so when I was talking in the trial, I said, I asked four or five people in the room what time it was. And it was 2 or 3 minutes difference between almost all of them, right? And so even like what time did this happen, right? We've got some level of bias. So there is, as Keller says, no view from nowhere. So there's not this... In other words, to say there is no God, according to Keller, and I think this is true, takes faith just as much as it does to say there is a God. There's some level of presumption there. There is no exclusively rational worldview. There are so many things we think that cannot be explained with what can be observed. And I talked about this a little bit last week about how there are just things that keep creeping up on our secular world that we just have a really hard time explaining. Let me read a little longer from Keller here. Let me see. These are two philosophers. Derrida and Habermas acknowledge that the humanistic moral values of secularism are not the deliverances of scientific reasoning, but have come down to us from older times, that they have a theological history. And modern people, Keller says, hold them by faith alone. In other words, the ideas that are so... There's a sociologist named Peter Berger, and he introduced me to this concept called a plausibility structure. That is, in each age, there's just sort of sets of beliefs, right? Axioms that we take for granted. We take for granted that people have a right to freedom. You know what I mean? I mean, we might have a revival in here if I keep talking like that, you know? Like as Americans, like, we're really passionate about that, aren't we? You know what I mean? And we used to beat the Canadians in hockey, guys. We got to get more fired up than this, you know? And so we love freedom. And we have, what if I said you don't have inalienable rights? It would really bother you, right? It would irk you a little bit. Because we have a basic understanding that people have inalienable rights that have been given to them by their creator. Now, that idea of basic human rights, right, given by God, is something that secular and non-secular people share in the United States. So then there are things that we're going to generally believe be more likely to believe than another era would be likely to believe. And that tendency to believe or not believe something is what Berger would call, if I'm not mistaken, a plausibility structure. And so, for us, right, if this was another continent and another time, and something weird happened, and they would be more likely to believe it was something demonic that happened, right, or something spiritual that happened. Something spiritual happening is dead last on our list of possibilities, right? Sort of like my joke about the strip club by the church last week. We're it's dead last on. Oh, those of you who weren't here, that's probably really confusing, isn't it? Yeah, I'm gonna leave it like that. You know, yeah, I think I'm just gonna leave it. By the way, I did say joke and not experience, just to clarify that. I do want to say that. I've never, no strip clubs by the church. We did have a boudoir photographer in the prayer garden one time. That's a good story. I'll tell y'all sometime if you want to ask me about it. Anyway, that was a crazy week. There's no exclusively rational worldview. Again, there's so many things that we think that can't be explained with just simply what we can observe with our senses. So the secular worldview it has limitations. So let me mention, I like the way Keller introduces evidence for God's existence. And I want to talk to y'all some about just evidence for God's existence tonight. Keller calls these, in The Reason for God, Tim Keller calls these the clues of God. These are clues that point to God's existence. Some people would call these arguments for the existence of God, but I kind of like this idea that Keller has that these are clues. These are signposts that are pointing us to the fact that there's a God. Now, I understand maybe I'm preaching the choir here a little bit. I hope I'm preaching the choir. I hope you guys believe in God. But the reality is, I think you'd do well to think through if you encounter someone who doesn't believe in God or who struggles with belief in God, or if you ever find yourself struggling with that. That's okay, by the way. I've struggled with that at times with my wife, and there are days, man. I mean, I'll just be honest. I mean, I know this is being recorded, and I believe in God. I hope that's clear. There are days when it all strikes me a little different than it does other days, you know? When just the implausibility that it feels like because of just the world we live in, and just, I mean, sometimes you look and you're reading the Bible and you're like, I believe that a crucified Jewish carpenter, right, from the backwaters of a subjugated nation is the king of the cosmos. And that he defeated sin, death, and the devil by dying on the cross, and then 3 days later he raised from the dead. Everybody's always like, resurrection is crazy because people don't just raise from the dead. Actually, for me, the crazier part is this idea that this nondescript person would be God himself, you know. Frankly, it's the counterintuitiveness of it is part of what continues to make Christian theism particularly compelling to me. A friend of mine pointed out an article several years ago that talked about ordering at restaurants. And I use this as an illustration one Easter. And everybody's got this committed to heart is what I mean by that. So I'm repeating myself. I know you all memorize my sermons. But he said, whenever you go to a restaurant, you look at the menu, you should be careful to order the most conventionally appetizing thing on the menu. In other words, you go to a restaurant, there's a half chicken on the menu. You know why there's a half chicken on the menu? Not because some guy there is like, man, I'm passionate about making half a chicken. You know, more than likely, it's on there because people order chicken. Okay? Now, if you go to a restaurant and a ribeye is on the menu, ribeye and a baked potato, more than likely, that chef's not back there like, man, I'm the best ribeye chef in the Southeast. More than likely, it's on there because when people go out to dinner, they want a salad and a baked potato and a ribeye and a roll with butter. You know what I mean? It's just, it's something people like when they go out to eat. You go to a menu and you've got beef cheeks on the menu. You know why that's on the menu? Beef cheeks are delicious, by the way. You know why beef cheeks are on the menu? Because that chef's passionate about beef cheeks. Because everybody gets the menu and they're like, I'm not getting beef cheeks. I'm getting half a roast chicken, right? I'm not getting frog legs. I'm getting a ribeye. I'm not getting this weird thing. I'm not getting sweetbreads, or I'm not getting this, or I'm not getting that. That sounds weird to me. I'm going to get this conventional thing. So typically what the guy says in the article, okay, is that the food that's on there that looks unappetizing to you is probably actually what the chef does best. And that the stuff on there that looks really appetizing to you is probably what the chef is not that passionate about and doesn't do that well, but he also has a mortgage, right? And so he says that's the case. So for me, these little things that are weird in the Bible are sort of the like beef cheeks, right? They're sort of the frog legs of the Bible. Like they know this is weird when they're writing it. You know what I mean? To me, this is one of the worst arguments against the Bible. People will always be like, people were so gullible back then. People just think, oh, a virgin can get pregnant. Like, guys, like, people knew where babies come from, okay? People have always known this, right? There's jokes about it in ancient times, just like there are now, you know? And so people were just so gullible. We just think there's a resurrection and a virgin birth happening on the corner. It's what Lewis would have called chronological snobbery. No, like, as the biblical authors are writing these things, they know that they're strange, right? But they're on the menu for a reason. I tend to believe it's because they're true. You know, you don't put, like, for example, the most prominent figure in your religion as the books are being read, you don't put them in there betraying the founder of your religion unless it's something that's true. But that's the case, I think, with like Peter betraying Jesus. And there's all kinds of examples of this throughout the Bible. That's all I have to say. Sometimes you look at it and it hits you weird. Okay? Some of y'all are like, frog legs, more like rabbit trails here. You know what I mean? You should have talked about rabbit. But the reality, though, is it hits you weird. Again, those things strengthen my faith. But there still are moments where there are moments where I'll have just this moment of doubt where I'm sort of like, man, this all feels, you know, you're just looking up at people driving around in cars and putting clothes on and stuff, and you're like, how is it possible that this is just the weirdest thing in the world that we exist and that this is happening? And so I have these moments sometimes. And so some of these things are helpful for me to kind of get regrounded in those moments. So Keller points out several clues for God and the reason for God, and I'm going to point out a couple and talk about them. One is what people have recently, or in the last few decades, what people call the Big Bang Theory. He says this is a clue for God. Now, I don't think what Keller's trying to do or what I'm trying to do is reconcile every single piece of scientific data with every aspect of the Bible. In fact, we've got stuck with a lot of really goofy, unbiblical doctrine by trying to do that. You might not know this, but science is a little quicker on its feet than Christianity is, right? So somebody throws out the geocentric theory, right? And all the scientists are like, that sounds pretty cool. That sounds pretty good. And then a few years later, like, never mind, heliocentric theory, sun's in the center, you know? But in the meantime, guess what? You read the Psalms, you read the Bible. There's a lot of examples in the Bible of language that makes it sound like the earth is the center of the universe. Okay? Now, I think that's, and frankly, if you just walk around in the world, right, you're assuming this is the center of the universe. You're assuming everything's kind of revolving. It looks like things are revolving around us, doesn't it? Unless you know better. Nobody's like watching the sunset and thinking, wow, we're rotating right now. That's not your initial thought, right? It looks like the sun's moving. Is everybody with me so far? It looks like the sun's moving. And so if I describe that, what do I say? I don't say, oh, wow, what a beautiful downward earth rotation we experienced tonight as we saw the sun dip beneath the bay out there. No, what do we say? The sun set. Well, that's language, right, that makes us all sound like a geocentric theorists, correct? It makes it sound like the sun's moving. Is everybody with me? And we're all these backwards cavemen that don't even know that the sun's... No, of course we're not, right? I think most of us here, I don't know. There may be some niche community that's in on the geocentric theory out there. I don't know. There are some niche communities I never would have dreamed exist that exist, so I don't know. But there's some language in the Bible that I would relate to something like saying the sunset. It's called phenomenological language, okay? Phenomenon is an observation, right? So when you say something from your perspective, okay, then and you're describing it in a phenomenological way, then you say something like the sun is setting. Nobody says then that means you believe the earth is the center of the universe and that the sun's revolving around it. You know that that's not the case, but we talk about our experiences and we describe them as we perceive them, as we see the phenomenon. So there's a lot of phenomenological language in the scriptures that would make it seem like the earth is the center of the universe. So when scientists say this, it's easy for a theologian, right, to be like, boom, yes, science is proving the Bible because that's what we need. And we jump on it, and then what happens is science moves on. Well, the church moves a lot slower, and then we get stuck with the geocentric theory, and they move on, and then they start making fun of us when we got the idea from them. So that's all I'd say. I want to be real careful with that. But it does feel like there's a lot of people out there who would argue that the universe had a very narrow beginning point. There was this major flash of energy that came from an infinitesimal point, and that everything existed in that from that moment. There seems to be a starting point to everything. So the universe shows evidence of beginning. Okay? Now, some of you may say, well, duh, you know, or whatever. Well, the problem, let me just tell you why this is a compelling clue for God's existence. And we might get in the weeds here. And if so, there's a lot of people who are going to be going back to Woody's class next week. Some of y'all can go with them if you feel like. This may be the most in the weeds we get, okay? I'm turning off the you can ask questions sign for a few minutes. Don't stop me. I've got to get through this. The only way through is out. Out is through. If something begins to exist, it must have a cause. There is no spontaneous beginning. Okay? There's no spontaneous life. Who was it that had the jars with the meat in them, and some with plastic and some without plastic? Maggots in the meat. Come on, somebody. Anyway. We know that life doesn't just, things don't happen spontaneously. The universe cannot beget itself. Something can't come from nothing, okay? So whatever begins to exist has to have a cause. And so something cannot come from nothing. If something could come into being from nothing, then it becomes inexplicable why anything or everything doesn't spring up out of nothing at any given moment. Right? What stopped something coming out of nothing? Why are there these seeming rules that govern the way things happen? Why are there not just infinite amounts of planets being being spawned at any given moment, or whatever. How is it that we've now reached some sort of stasis? Why would it just be a one-time thing? This is something that I've struggled with for years. I told everybody last week, I try to kind of like pit the best forms of arguments as I see them against each other over time. And this is one of the things I feel like if I were an atheist, I'd have the hardest time with, is and we're going to talk about this, the fine-tuning of Earth for life. And so it's fine-tuned for life, right? Is everybody with me on this? Like, for human life, the kind of habitation we have, and no other planets around us at least have life on them. My question would be, though, if we sort of appeared randomly here, and creatures and everything else appeared randomly here, why would these be the only ingredients for life? Okay, like why would these be, why wouldn't life appear randomly in other places under other sets of circumstances? We're saying this is the only place that can sustain life because it sustains our kind of life, right? Well, what makes Mars inhospitable from some other sort of evolutionary life developing? I don't understand that. and I think it's a big lacuna in the argument for evolution or materialism. So, universe shows evidence of beginning. Whatever begins to exist has a cause. And something cannot come into being from nothing. But what about God? Okay? All right, this is where it gets fun. Why is it that we would believe that God could exist? Why do we need there to be a God for a universe to have existed? Well, for one, the universe began to exist. There was a time when the universe was not, right? So it can't come from nothing. And you say, well, can God come from nothing? No, but the reality is, if you were to say, well, maybe some other universe begat this universe, right? Maybe there was some pre-existence that this was born out of or whatever else. Well, the problem becomes that eventually you needed some cause for that universe as well, right? And the one for that one before it, and the one for that one before it, and the one for that one before it. And it becomes a reductio ad absurdum, where you go on infinitely backwards over time. So there's an illustration for this. I think it's called Hilbert's Hotel, which is, imagine there's a hotel with an infinite amount of rooms in it, right? And there's an infinite amount of rooms. And somebody comes and checks in, and they're saying, can I have a room? And they say yes. And then you go on, and multiple people come and check in, and rooms are infinitely available. What happens when somebody decides to check out? Does that room cease to exist? No, not exactly, right? But the reality is that eventually you get to this absurdity where you cannot have infinity and not infinity at the same time. And so what you wind up saying is the same thing is true about the universe that has existed eternally as you would say about God. Well, the evidence doesn't point to that, and it's philosophically absurd to believe that that's the case. Something cannot come from nothing. And the universe began to exist, and energy tends toward disorder until it reaches some sort of equilibrium. So if the universe is eternal, like, why would we even still be here? Like, how did any of these things ever happen? So the reality is that all these things, all these truths about what the universe is and what it's like, tend to point toward the fact that the universe has a cause. And the reality is that the universe has a cause. It can't be the universe. It has to be something other than this. Is everybody with me? There's two things in the cosmos. There's stuff, that's us, all the stuff around us, right? The created things. And there's God. And if God is not infinite in himself, then eventually all logic and everything's going to break down. Or we're going to have to apply what we believe about God to the universe. There's an implication that there's something that created it, and it must be a God. And a creator by his very nature, must be godlike to be distinct from the universe. So I think the universe has a cause. And the cause of the universe must be transcendent, a transcendent cause beyond the universe. It must be an uncaused first cause. There must be something that causes things that's uncaused. It must transcend space and time since it created them, right? So it must be immaterial. And it must be personal, or a being or mind. It must be a mind because it cannot be abstract. And it must be personal because the universe actually started. Somebody somewhere had to make a decision to do this, right? And I say all that to say that I think all these things point toward theism. That's a clue of God. One clue of God is the Big Bang Theory. Another is the fine-tuning of the universe. Let me read Keller to you really quickly, 131. From Reason for God. He says, Alvin Plantinga gives an illustration. He imagines a man dealing himself 20 straight hands of four aces in the same game of poker. As his companions reach for their six shooters, the poker player says, I love thinking about Alvin Plantinga in this saloon with the guys with the six shooters. You should just look up a picture of Alvin Plantinga sometime. They reach for their six shooters, and the poker player says, I know it looks suspicious, but what if there is an infinite succession of universes so that for any possible distribution of poker hands, there is one universe in which this possibility is realized? We just happen to find ourselves in one where I always deal myself four aces without cheating. This argument will have no effect on the other poker players. It is technically possible that the man just happened to deal himself 20 straight hands of four aces. Though you could not prove he had cheated, it would be unreasonable to conclude that he hadn't. In other words, the fine-tuning of the universe for life, Plantinga finds really compelling. And he says it would be sort of like this situation. It feels like there has to be some sort of ulterior motive for Earth to be uniquely suitable for life, at least life as we know it. I think we are at a place culturally where, as a pastor, it is important for me to address the idea of the possibility of life outside Earth. I have felt like for a long time there is the possibility, and it would bother me none whatsoever, that there might be some forms of life outside Earth. Okay? That's never been a challenge to me. If we find a microbe somewhere, we find a creature somewhere, something like that, it's not a problem for me. Obviously, I feel like there are layers of complication that come if there's intelligent life beyond Earth. Now, I'm not convinced at this point, but it does feel like there are unquestionably phenomenon that's beyond our ability to clearly explain with the technology and the situations, everything else that we have just here on Earth. I think the lazy way out is just to say, oh, it must be demons. You know, I think there are Christians who make that argument. They just kind of go automatically to that. I've heard arguments, you know, along those lines. I could be wrong on that. You know what I mean? If I meet an alien, I'll test the spirit or whatever. But I do feel like there's more and more sort of at least pointing, and it's bipartisan pointing at this point, toward the possibility that there's something going on that our government or others don't understand. That's the understatement of the year. I'll be the first to admit that we don't need aliens for that, right? But I will just say that I think that's the case. So I am, as a Christian, open to the possibility that God can do whatever he wants with his creation, right? And that there's a possibility that God created life beyond Earth. I'm not I don't think you have to have a tinfoil hat collection to think that that's possible. I think it's something we need to be really careful with as Christians, right? Any sort of a UFOlogy or any sort of a sort of extraterrestrial thought process, we need to be really careful with and try to think through it through a biblical worldview, which I think is really important. What I will say is, I think former President Obama, President Trump, in recent, like in the last couple of weeks, have both kind of pointed to some evidence that they, you know, that they're saying, sort of like acting like it's true in ways that is really odd for people who are or have been presidents. I shouldn't say that I necessarily think it's morally wrong when I say odd. I just mean it's way out of the norm. So the reality that at that point is, I feel like there have been times when people said, well, if we ever find aliens, like that's it for Christianity. You know what I mean? Or whatever. Or there's sort of the other ditch of just, well, it must just, anything out of the ordinary that doesn't neatly fit within our already existing sort of categories must therefore be demonic or whatever else. I think we got to be really careful and nuanced as we think through those things. So I just felt like it was a good moment to stop for a second and say, when we were talking about things like the fine-tuning of the universe, we may at some point find some evidence that there's life outside Earth. My Christian worldview is not going to immediately crumble if that were to happen. And I'm not convinced it will. I'm not convinced. First of all, I'm not convinced it's not demons, okay? So let me just go ahead and get that out there, right? I'm not convinced that there's not demonic activity going on out there. I think a lot of spooky, scary stuff is demonic activity, and they're trying to make us think about, you know, paranormal, weird stuff instead of thinking about a biblical cosmology. So I do think some sort of deceptive work is possible. I'll also say, big C.S. Lewis guy here, I think like what Lewis did in the Space Trilogy is really, if you've never read the Space Trilogy, I would pick that up. Is the first one Out of the Silent Planet? Is that the first one, Ben? Everybody in here looked at Ben when I said that. I'm trying to see. Jake might know. Jake, is that the first one? Out of the Silent Planet is not the first one?
Pre-Landing is the second one, so I think Out of the Silent Planet.
And That Hideous Strength is third, right? It's the last one?
Yes.
Yeah, Paralandra's two for sure. I got stuck halfway through Paralandra. But I will say, I do love Out of the Silent Planet so much. And what Lewis does there is, I find, really interesting. So, there's also something I find really compelling, and it's the regularity of nature. I just find the fact that we seem to live in a closed system really fascinating. You know, people can figure things out about the universe, and then 10 years later, they're not different, right? Like, 2 plus 2 is anybody, I mean, I know there's new math, but 2 plus 2 is still 4, right? Okay? That's reflective of, that's reflective of, by the way, my kids started telling me about new math, you know? I'm really bad at math. So all over the years, I've come up with all these tricks in my mind to try to make up for being bad at math. I've come up with all this stuff. My kids started telling me about this new math they're making them do. And he's like, this is crazy. And I was like, oh, no, I've been doing this forever. You know, for kids, new math's horrible for kids that are good at math. I get that, because if you're good at math, you know, I mean, old math's just math. But if you're terrible at math, new math's pretty good. Okay, that's all I'm going to say. I invented it. Sixth grade, Boaz Middle School. New math. The regularity of nature, that math is a constant, right? That, like, we can build airplanes. Isn't that amazing? We don't have to redesign airplanes every few years. Now, we improve upon them, right? But physics doesn't change, right? I mean, I'm very, very grateful for that. I know y'all are kind of looking at me like, what did you take a gummy before this or something? But, like, what I'm trying to say right now is, like, I want you to think about, because think about how accustomed you are to the fact that nothing, that the world doesn't change, or the rules of the world, that there's a regularity to nature. Think about how strange it is for you to observe that that's the case. What in the world would make all the regularity of nature that the case if all of this was random? Why would these patterns emerge this way? What would make this world emerge versus a totally random world, or a world where everything changes all the time? I think it's a clue that this was created by design. I find that compelling. And let me also just say that Keller talks about the way that evolutionistic materialism is sort of a what he calls a clue killer. It's this sort of omni-thought that tries to make sense of everything. But it ultimately fails at it because our pure rationalism should be mistrusted just as much, presumably, as faith should be mistrusted in this sense. So these aren't just clues, but it's something for us to think about when we need to ask ourselves, does pure rationality and reason actually do for me all that I think it does? Right? Is every question I think is being answered? I don't think that's the case. And then I think we might ask ourselves a question like, especially if we were secular thinkers, is it as unreasonable as people make it out to be to believe that maybe God is the one who's behind these things? So that's what we sort of are thinking about when we ask the question, is it reasonable to believe in God? I certainly don't think it's unreasonable to, and contrary to sort of popular notion. All right, really quickly, let's just move through this idea of what if there is no God? What if there is no God? The sort of modern hymn is the old John Lennon song, Imagine There's No Heaven. It's easy if you try. I don't know if y'all remember this. A bunch of celebrities sang this during COVID, and everybody got big mad about it, understandably, because it's like the most dismal, miserable thing to hear. It's like, hey, we're rich, and sort of y'all are all in your shanties out there, and we're all living in mansions, and we're going to talk to you about the hopelessness of the universe in the hardest days of your life. And so they sang this song. Imagine there's no heaven. It's easy if you try. No hell below us, above us only sky. Imagine all the people living for today. Imagine there's no countries. It isn't hard to do. Nothing to kill or die for, no religion too. Imagine all the people living life in peace. You may say I'm a dreamer, but I'm not the only one. Hope someday you'll join us and the world will be as one. It just sounds like communist China and the USSR, right? You know, when you hear those things, just peaceful, everybody loving each other. Obviously not. This is kind of the secular hymn in so many ways. A lot of people find it compelling. But there is this sort of sense in the world. If we could just get rid of religion and judgmentalism and all this different kind of stuff, everybody could just live in peace and everything would be fine and everything would be good. But the reality is, friends, that over time, life without God becomes absurd. And over time, whatever it is we've come to hold dear really unravels over time. I need to find a way to show it. It's really hard to find. But there's a sketch comedy show that I like a lot called Portlandia. Have any of you guys ever seen Portlandia? It's a great show. And I hate to ruin this skit for you, but it's a great one. Fred Armisen's real involved in it, and I think Fred Armisen is particularly hilarious. So, by and large, Portlandia is going to have a more left-leaning bent toward it in lots of ways. It's satire Portland, but these are people who are sort of immersed in the Portland culture and everything that are lambasting their own culture. So, one sketch they did I found particularly funny where the female is in her apartment and she hears this like really loud music playing, right? She goes next door and she's like, hey, I need you to, can you turn that down? This is really disruptive, right? And he says, you know, I'm sorry, I can't do that. I'm living my truth. And she's like, okay. And he's like, you do you. And she's like, all right. And he just keeps playing his music as loud as he wants. Well, then she goes in another day and she hears like screams and stuff from the apartment and like power tools, all this kind of stuff. And she like knocks on the door and he opens the door and there's like blood on his face or whatever. And she's like, hey, what's going on in there? And he's like, oh, I'm just living my truth, you know? I'm just trying to be my authentic self here. And anyway, she's flipping out. Eventually the police come, right? And they realize he's been murdering people and doing all this kind of stuff in there. And the police come and they're like, hey, you're under arrest. And he comes out and he's like, hey, I know what you're trying to do here, but I want you to know I'm just trying to be the most authentic version of myself. I'm just living my truth here. And the cop's like, oh man, I didn't know that. We'd hate to get in the way of you doing you. And He's like, thanks, guys. And they're like, we all just need to live our truth or whatever. And then finally, the girl that lives next door is like, what about my truth? And the cop says, yeah, you're going to want to move. And so the reality is, right, that eventually whatever morality we have that's divorced from the idea of God telling us what's right and wrong eventually devolves, right, into what's good for me, what's true for you is true for you, what's true for me is true for me. Eventually, those realities are gonna smack up against each other. Portlandia, I feel like, nailed it in a way that also happened to be pretty funny. So that to say that there's an absurdity to the idea of life without God. For one, it's ignoring reality. We live in what, I mean, I think Francis Schaeffer would call a sort of two-tiered universe. There's that what we can see. He would have called that the phenomenal. And then there's that which we cannot see, the noumenal. And so it's that second story that we moderns have a hard time with, right? Let me give you another word for that, metaphysical realities. Modern world has a hard time with the metaphysical, right? That there's something we can't see going on. People have a real, real hard time with that. I mean, if you watch any sort of TV, I mean, this theme is explored all the time. What do we do with things we can't quite make sense of? I don't know if you guys have ever watched any of the Knives Out movies, but the latest one deals with this theme pretty considerably. I'm not going to get into it because I'm not going to spoil it, but a lot of faith-based themes there, and a lot of Benoit Blanc, played by Daniel Craig, is like a pretty staunch atheist, and his faith in atheism gets challenged in this one. Has anybody seen that movie? You guys seen that yet? You've seen it right here, my man in the back.
I've seen the, is there two of them right
now? There's three.
There's three, I've seen two of them.
Oh, yeah. Not the but the last one's is a really good one. You should watch it. So, but Benoit Blanc's an atheist, right? And he gets like rattled by this particular case. So, I still have to say that it's that second tier that our culture has, that second story that our culture has a hard time with, right? So, for example, I won't go into all the details right now, but Whitney and I, after Jim was born, went through a situation where Whitney had a medical condition that would have, after Jim was born, would have changed our lives pretty significantly. And so we went to a specialist at UAB, and I mean, well, we went to her doctor and then wound up getting referred to a specialist at UAB, and he'd seen all the different stuff and the symptoms that she was experiencing, just kind of quit. And we went to him and he says, I have no explanation for this. You know, it shouldn't have healed. This shouldn't have happened. I don't have an explanation for this. Of course, Whitney and but by the way, I'm a Bible guy, gospel guy. I mean, I think the main miracle we need to be looking at is the resurrection of the Lord Jesus Christ. I think talking about miracles all the time can become kind of a distraction from the gospel if we're not careful. But at the same time, I mean, I genuinely believe that God healed my wife, right? If there's something a doctor couldn't explain, something we couldn't explain, something nobody could explain, I feel like the answer there, right, is that God intervened. But we have a hard time with that second story, don't we? Like, things we can't explain. And things happen that doctors can't explain, that I can't explain, that scientists can't explain. And so eventually we start ignoring the reality that there's stuff going on out there. And I don't even just mean something like a miracle. We get lifted up into the metaphysical more often than we'd like to think. I just don't, I talked about this last week, like, I don't feel like there's a sense in which evolution, to me, I've not heard a good argument for how evolution could explain why we would get like emotional at the Grand Canyon. Or material, how does materialism explain that? And I told everybody, Woody cried at the Grand Canyon, for goodness sakes. So, I mean, something's going on, you know what I mean? And there's something happening there. And the same with lots of other situations. When a child is born, okay, you ever thought about that? We get emotional at the end of maybe the most basic biological process. I mean, it's like the definition of evolutionary processes, right? Scientific processes. And yet, you hold your baby, you cry. I mean, everybody's, you know, all this different kind of stuff. It's amazing. People are excited. People bring you balloons and all this kind of stuff. And, you know, there's something beautiful happening there. And it transcends, right? It transcends. I've not seen a baboon meal train yet. Okay, And something transcendent's happening when a human being is born. And we're experiencing something, right, that is not happening at a dog kennel when a child is born. I think not only does it ignore reality in that sort of second tier, but also it gives us a life with no ultimate meaning. No ultimate meaning. And so we long for meaning. Isn't that interesting? I find that really fascinating that we sort of long to make meaning out of things. You know what I mean? Like I said, I've got two dogs at home. I've never had one ask me anything ever about explaining one thing ever. You know, yes, goodness gracious, I've got three kids that I'm explaining things to 24/7, you know. Imagine these, but they're not interested in anything but their appetites, right? Just fulfilling what they want to do. Now, if a dog comes up on the screen, sometimes I'm like, maybe there's something in there, you know what I mean? But then the dog goes off the screen and it's like, you know, they start, I don't know, licking themselves again or something. And I'm like, never mind, you know, like, never mind. Okay, so no ultimate meaning, no ultimate value for human beings. Devoid of God, what value is there to human life? What if there is no God, what makes human life more valuable than any other life? By the way, there have been... Hold on. Yeah. Who did I say? Berger. Yeah, okay, good. I thought I'd made a crucial error. Peter Berger is the philosopher that introduced the term plausibility structure. I'm about to talk about another one named Peter Singer, who's an ethicist, I think, at Princeton. And we start getting like live fact-checking in my classes, like a debate or something. Anyway, I think Singer was at Princeton. He was in Ivy League, I believe. He was an ethicist. And he would argue that a human fetus has no more rights than a pig until it's like 2 years old, because their cognitive abilities would be the same up until that point. Okay? Now, all of us in the room are like, that is really scary thinking. Right? But what if you didn't believe in God? What argument do you have against that? We're not like babies more? You know, I mean, we like, if God didn't give us special meaning, like, and if a baby at 1 year old and an adult pig basically have the same cognitive skill set, what makes it okay to kill and eat a pig but not okay to kill and eat a baby if there is no God? And everybody's really uncomfortable right now as we... Isn't that kind of proof that I think that's more than just a taboo? Okay. So one replacement for that value, though, is I think this is one reason why politics are such a huge idol in our culture and society, is because we need something to be the arbiter of value when we've lost a shared sense of who God is. Okay, and then no ultimate... purpose. We lose an ultimate purpose real quickly. This is Keller talking about identity. In all former cultures, people developed a self by moving toward others, seeking their attachment. We found ourselves, as it were, in the faces of others. But modern secularism teaches that we can develop ourselves only by looking inward, by detaching and leaving home, religious communities, and all other requirements, so that we can make our own choices and determine who we are for ourselves. In other words, when you lose a sense of God giving us the world as it is, we begin to look inward for our purpose, and we start to find it in our identity. If you've ever been curious about how we sort of got in the situation we're in the world, so much of it is rooted in us finding our purpose in our own identity. By the way, I wrote in the margins there when I read this book the first time, every Disney movie ever. And so if you think about it, like, this is so often when Moana, we're not like anti-Disney movies, we just try to use it as an opportunity to talk to our kids and hope, you know. But we watched Moana with my daughter one time, and, you know, she's got that song, and she yells out, like, I am Moana or whatever. For some reason, the first few times I heard it, I thought she said, I am a woman. And I remember telling my wife, like, that makes me feel kind of weird that she's saying, like, I am a woman like that. Like, I don't know what that means exactly. Like, is she, I don't understand exactly. I'm not nothing against being a woman, you know. I just felt like it was a really weird thing to sing at that point in the movie. And Whitney's like, Matt, she's saying, I am Moana, you know what I mean? But again, even better example of her coming to this moment where she is like the crescendo of the film, in the middle of the crescendo of the song, and she's really talking about her own personal identity, divorced from her family. Now, to be fair, she does go back to the island and serve an important role, and there's some good themes there too, right? But not all bad, but there is some of that there. So, reality, as any of it of us knows it, cuts against all these challenges when we think about what it might be like if there was no God. We're built to long for meaning. We naturally see human life as having intrinsic worth. We see a sense of purpose in things. And so for me, there's a sense in which it is irrational to believe that there's no God at all, simply because I can't find a way to make sense from any sort of a materialistic worldview of so many things about who we are and how we think and what we do that are not just true in sort of Western civilization that's been shaped by Christianity, but true of humans across the world. It's really, I think, a huge stretch to get to the idea that there is no God because of those realities. 2 minutes late. I'm sorry. Thanks, everybody. Have a good night.